Welcome back to the program. Much as the printing press and later the telegraph and the telephone transformed the speed and transmission of information, so the Internet may be an even more powerful and profound force. It may very well be the biggest transformation in human connectivity since the invention of language itself. The question today is that while we live and work amidst the impact of this transformation, there is so much that we still don't know in real time about its challenges and about its long-term impact, its impact on our economies, our governance, our laws, and our business. Are we more efficient or merely more stressed today? Are we better managers or just better jugglers? Do we control this newfound connectivity, or does it control us? These are just a few of the questions we're going to talk about today with my guest, William Davidow. He has been a high technology industry executive, a venture investor for more than 30 years. He's been at the cutting edge of the transformation that we've been talking about. He served as a senior vice president of marketing and sales at Intel. He's held positions at Hewlett Packard and General Electric. And he's the author of a new book entitled Overconnected, The Promise and the Threat of the Internet. William Davidow, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Jeff.
Great to have you here. When we think about the Internet, what context should we put it in with respect to communications technology overall? How does it stack up with the transformations that took place with respect to the telephone, the telegraph, the steam engine? Where does it fit, do you think, first of all, in that pantheon?
Well, I believe that it is the most powerful form of communication interaction in the history of mankind, short of language, which you mentioned, because it is so universal and so broad and so fast, and you can carry so much information with it, so that it's extremely powerful, and in many respects, we haven't evolved to keep up with it.
Right. When you say that we haven't evolved, I mean, certainly we haven't evolved, and we'll talk more about this in terms of the way we do business and our governance and our laws. But what about strictly from a kind of biological evolutionary point of view and our ability to keep up with that kind of pace?
Well, for 2.5 million years, man has been co-evolving with his tools in physical space. And in the past 25 years, 1/100th of that time, we've moved into virtual space. All of our emotional systems are attuned to the physical space. That's what they were designed for. And suddenly, we're exposing them to this new world, and we're trying to use them in ways that they weren't designed for.
Why do you think, Bill, that we haven't had more conversation about this sort of broader subject? You know, we talk about a lot about the various tools that are connected to the Internet, but this broader conversation in terms of the impact that it's having, we really haven't talked much about.
Well, we don't truly understand what the Internet is doing to us sociologically, psychologically, or neurologically. And that's that's one distinct area. The other area that we don't really understand what it's doing is to our institutions, and those being things like business, government, regulatory agencies, free markets, and things like this. And all of those institutions as well were conceived in a time when they evolved in physical space, and suddenly we're moving them into virtual space. And things don't work quite the same way. As an example, Adam Smith's concept of a free market was a free market in physical space where you had local neighbors and you had a lot of moral control because you had to meet the people in church that you were doing business with. And that was a very different situation than a banker today who is doing business with you who you may not even see.
Right. This notion, though, of a free flow of ideas and a free flow of money, even though it certainly hasn't happened at the speed that it happens today, is something that we have been moving towards for a relatively long time.
We absolutely have been moving towards it. And one of the points in the book was that when that motion was slower, our institutions were capable of adapting. You know, for example, the railroad had a transformative effect on society, but it was constrained by its very physical nature. We had to lay the railroad tracks. We had to build the bridges. We had to improve the steam engines. And the transformation that the railroad put on society took place over 100 years. Suddenly the internet comes along, and the transformation is taking place in years and months, and it's transforming the way markets operate so that the financial markets are operating in a totally different way today than they were 10 years ago.
And is it transforming human relationships within the context of markets and governance in ways that we don't yet fully understand?
Well, absolutely, but I don't think we understood all of that when the railroad was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And but once again, we had more time. One of the points I make in the book is that I say we get to where we're going before we realize we've gotten there. And when markets evolved more slowly, you had time to adjust to things. For example, if you look at derivatives, which were the one of the financial instruments that got us in trouble in the 2008 financial crisis, in the year 2000, the over-the-counter derivatives market consisted of $60 trillion worth of notional value. 7 years later, it consisted of $600 trillion of notional value. And just being off a fraction of $600 trillion is a lot of money.
To what extent has there been this disconnect between the financial markets in particular, and you talk a lot about it with respect to the 2008-2009 financial crisis and what happened in Iceland and some of these points, to what extent has there been this huge disconnect between financial markets' willingness to plunge into this and to use this connectivity, even though it may not be fully understood or regulated, and the refusal, really, of governance to even talk about or understand the full implications of what's going on?
Well, I'd like to use an analogy. Boeing is working on the 787 today. And if Boeing said to the public, look, we're going to let 10 of these things crash and then put in the safety mechanism, the public would be up in arms. But with financial innovation, we're putting in place these very, very powerful financial instruments, and we're saying we're going to get around to figuring out how they should be regulated after the crash. So the time to do something about the derivative market was when we realized that it was $60 trillion and growing at a compounded rate of 40% a year in the year 2000, so that the internet puts tremendous pressure to us to sort of try and anticipate problems and act aggressively before they occur.
When one looks at what happened with respect to the financial markets, to derivatives and some of these other areas, is it your sense from the interviews that you did, the people you talked to, that this was something that was a conscious decision that people made, that these opportunities were there? Or is it something that was more organic and evolutionary within the context of the markets coupled with the connectivity?
Well, I think what happened is that people saw opportunities, and in a free market system, they have tremendous incentives to exploit those opportunities. And they did that. And I don't think that any of them are, that's probably too broad, but that I don't think that very few ever did it with anticipating that they were going to cause great harm. I don't believe people are that evil. But I do believe that they pursued their own interests, and in many cases they pursued them somewhat thoughtlessly.
Why have the financial markets been so much, certainly the economic incentive is a big part of the answer, but the financial markets much more willing to embrace the technology, even if it didn't fully understand it, particularly in real time, than our laws and our governance has been?
Well, you've got to realize that financial markets are basically information markets, and money is an information media. And so it just maps perfectly on to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at governance, it basically is something that has always taken place in the physical world. And if you think of that, you've got county government and city government and state government, and it's fixated on geography. And suddenly, we're moving into a virtual space, and the virtual space doesn't respect geography. So that if you look at things like financial regulation, in the past, you regulated the market in the United States, and you regulated the market in Japan, and suddenly the financial market has moved to international virtual space,
mm-hmm.
as have the free press with things like WikiLeaks and other things like this. And we're experiencing phenomena, whether it might be copyright law or things like that, where the law depended for a great deal of its authority on the fact that the things that it wanted to regulate fit within inside its geographic boundaries.
Which brings us sort of to the initial question, and kind of turning it on its head a little bit, is the problem that we are overconnected, or is the problem really that too many parts of our society are underconnected within this context?
Well, I in the book I distinguish between highly connected and overconnected. And what really is important is that the two sort of mesh together and work together. And in the 1920s and 30s, there was a sociologist named William Ogburn who defined a term called cultural lag. And what he said is, you get into problems when one part of the culture changes and the other part doesn't keep up. And that's pretty much what's going on with the internet today. Institutions are changing, and other institutions are remaining fairly static, and the two are dramatically out of step. And so it turns out that this can lead to all kinds of exploitations and things like this that just wouldn't have happened before the internet. Now, the internet is a wonderful thing in the sense that it creates these opportunities, and it's created the Googles and the Facebooks, and it's created the Amazons, and it's created wonderful institutions, but it also presents us with the problem that we have many institutions that are out of step.
As we look at the developing world in the context of this, and we see a world that is developing, making use of, benefiting from, economically and in many other ways, all of this connectivity without the institutions that are already in place, to what extent are we seeing that evolve differently?
I'm not quite sure I know how to answer that question. But what happens is that you are suddenly connecting developing countries much more directly with developed countries. And you're connecting their markets more directly. You're creating, as a result of this, economic opportunity for them, and things like that.
I mean, the analogy, I suppose, is the telephone business, where you have, you know, cell phones emerging in the developing world without the infrastructure that might have been there before for hardwired phones. I mean, it has a totally different impact on those developing countries.
That's definitely true, and in a sense, you're giving people access to news without newspapers, and that may be the analogy you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. And do we have a sense, as those markets develop, of how it might help us better adapt here in the West?
Well, you know, that's a tough question because, you know, in the past, those markets developed at a very slow rate,
right.
And so both sides had a chance to somewhat adjust to them. And you are obviously concerned about the situation in Africa. The one I've thought a lot more about is the situation that exists relative to China,
mm-hmm.
where there's been we've benefited tremendously from our trade relationship with China, but we've also seen many, many jobs migrate there. And the rate at which the jobs can migrate there has been a function of the fact that the Internet exists and we can control the supply chains better and we can get information over there better. And as a result, we've lost jobs at an extremely rapid rate. Well, if the Internet never existed, and that rate of loss would have been much slower, and it would have given our economy and the people in our economy more chance to adjust. And so that it's the rapidity of which these things happen. And, you know, the fact that cultures change slowly, but and our habits change slowly, but business transformation races ahead at a very, very rapid rate.
And to what extent is generational change a part of this, given that there is this cultural shift taking place?
Well, the generational change thing is really interesting, because so much of what we have done in the past has been dependent on different modes of communication and different modes of interaction. And suddenly we've got a generation that interacts very differently than I did when I was growing up, where everything was face-to-face and the telephone was about as advanced as it got. And suddenly we've got a generation that is communicating much more broadly, and I think at a shallower level. And at the same time, they are enjoying it, and it's leading to a different form of relationship that I think is more transactional rather than a deep level of emotional commitment between people.
Is it fair, though, I mean, and this goes to the broader questions we're talking about, is it fair for us that sort of grew up in a kind of different world to judge it as necessarily being shallower as opposed to simply different and one that hasn't sort of set down its own roots for connectivity within this environment?
Well, I think you're asking a good question, and I keep coming back to where you started this discussion,
uh-huh.
And I will tell you that for 2.5 million years, mankind evolved in physical space, and we know that our brain would be different if it had evolved for hundreds of thousands of years in virtual space, and so I suspect that emotionally, we've got a lot to learn about what this means. But I think you're asking a much deeper question, because I believe that individuals today are in much the same situation as the newspapers are in many respects, where the newspapers were not designed for virtual space. And I can give you an example of which I'm not as knowledgeable as I'd like to be, but it appears that we have a dopamine response to the constant interactions that go on in our lives as they're interrupted by tweets and emails. The dopamine response was originally there to protect mankind against the assaults from being eaten by tigers. And suddenly we're getting shots of dopamine to keep us being consumed while we're being consumed by the Internet. And dopamine wasn't meant to be used that way. So we don't understand these things. And you really need to talk to psychologists and neurologists and biologists to get a better insight into that.
And talk about it from a public policy perspective, because it is probably the single place, I would perhaps argue, that we are weakest in having this conversation.
Well, the public policy place is a very difficult place to have this discussion, because from a public policy point of view, our policymakers are vested in geographic space. And I'll give you an example. From the Bay Area, we have city governance, county governance, and state governance,
uh-huh.
but we have regional problems. And any policymaker looking at that situation today, I think, who is objective, would say, oh my gosh, we need a form of regional governance, and maybe county governance doesn't make a lot of sense because the county lines don't mean much anymore. We're all part of the Bay Area. Now, I think it would be relatively difficult to have a discussion among the policymakers of saying, you know, why don't we give up county governance? Or something like this, so we can solve the Bay Area transportation problems and the Bay Area congestion problems and the Bay mm-hmm. Area housing problems. You need institutions that are capable of dealing with that, that have that aren't necessarily based on the county lines that are drawn.
Right.
And I could extend that argument to the federal government as well, because it seems to me that all of these things were designed in a time very much on the basis of a lower level of connectivity.
But part of the problem that we're seeing is that all of this connectivity and all of this speed that we were talking about earlier is breeding to a certain extent in a part of the public an insecurity which is leading to a greater desire in many cases for exactly the kind of tribalism or local connectivity that is counter to what we really need to be doing.
Well, I think you've hit the nail right on the head, and that is what I would define as overconnectivity, because you've got what I would call a local mentality to protect ourselves, which I think is very natural, trying to deal with a global environment, and where you've got to solve problems globally. And so, and I'd like to just take it back to the Bay Area. What it means is that, you know, I live near Palo Alto. It means that if I really want to solve the regional problems in San Francisco or in the San Francisco Bay Area, as a citizen of Palo Alto, I've got to be willing to cede some of that authority to some kind of regional or county governance. And I can understand, as a citizen in the Palo Alto area, why I might not want to do that. So those are the kinds of problems that connectivity presents us with.
Have we learned anything? Have policymakers, or have we learned anything with respect to financial markets from the recent crash? And will that engender any changes that address some of the things that we're talking about?
Well, I think from the financial markets, we've learned a great deal. I think it should help us do that. Once again, I say we've learned it. I think I've taken different lessons from it than some of the regulators. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that we have too much positive feedback in the system. And positive feedback in the system, I mean as an engineer. And it's like if you have a savings account and you get 3% interest, the interest gets fed back into your account, and it causes it to grow. And if you get 5% interest, it causes it to grow much faster. And these positive feedback processes drive things to extreme. And what we have to do is reduce the amount of positive feedback in the system so that the markets become less volatile. What the regulators are trying to do is to put in place regulation that will do that. And I think overall, we've got to be very careful that attempt to find ways to reduce the volatility or the amount of positive feedback we have in the system.
How do regulators do that without interfering with the basic principles of connectivity?
Well, one way is through things like taxes. Another way is by putting in place a labyrinth of rules, which are very hard to do in these highly complex environments. So those are the types of things, and they create violent debates. One of the ways they were doing it was by forcing the investment banks to become regulated banks. And that reduced the amount of leverage they could take on. By doing that, as an example, the investment banks were able to take on, prior to this regulation, leverage of about 30 to 1, which meant that if they lost 3 cents on the dollar, they were bankrupt, and now they have to have can only take on leverage of around 10 to 1. The effect of that is to reduce their power and a lot of the volatility in the market. So those types of things can happen. On a social level, it's harder for me to see how you reduce the volatility in the market. Facebook is a remarkable thing,
mm-hmm.
and it's grown to, 500, 600 million users, and it obviously is transforming our lives, but we have no understanding of what that is going to do to the structure of society.
Have we reached a kind of technological plateau at the moment in terms of this connectivity that might allow us to take a better look at all of these things, or is the technology still advancing in ways that we just can't keep up with?
Well, the technology is going to continue to advance, and I don't see it slowing down at all. But I think that we can, as individuals, do certain things. The question I have in my life is whether I move my life to virtual space or whether I use these technologies to augment my life in physical space. And by that I mean, do I use it to augment communication, or do I go to the restaurant with people and all of us take out our iPhones
right.
and smartphones and sit around and surf the internet while we eat? And if I'm using the smartphone to arrange my day more efficiently and to conduct business more efficiently, it's a very different thing than if I use the smartphone as the environment in which I live. And I give this example. There are fish. There are three separate occasions of fish evolving with two sets of eyes. And I tell people that if we had really evolved for the internet-based world, we'd have two sets of ears, one for listening to music and another for listening to whether I was going to get hit by an automobile when I was out jogging. And so we have to be very, very careful of the way we let these wonderful advances impact our lives.
Is part of it, though, right now that there is still a novelty factor to all of this, and that we haven't figured out how to achieve, even within our own personal lives, as you're talking about, the appropriate balance?
Hey, it absolutely is. I found myself this morning really conflicted. I was searching the internet on my iPad thinking, gee, there's this great book over here I want to read about evolution. And I'm constantly reading the book on evolution is a lot more work than surfing the internet on my iPad. And so I'm constantly driven to this immediate gratification fun experience that I have over here. And I sort of procrastinate on doing the other things. And it's a challenge for everybody.
I mean, there's a program. It's interesting. There's a program I know students, college students particularly, use a lot, and I guess others as well, that will basically lock you. You can set it to lock you out of the internet for a certain amount of time while you're working on a paper or doing something that you actually need to concentrate on.
Well, the great achievements of mankind have all been a result of focus. And maybe that's too big a generalization, but they've been a result of a sort of linear thought where I take one idea, I add another idea to it, and I create an advance, and then I add another idea to it, and I create a more advanced things. And I think that The Internet tends to get you involved in horizontal interaction, and it creates big challenges to what I would call linear thought. And to me, in my life, I think it's really important that I try to maintain that balance, because you don't want to become a Luddite. You want to stay in touch. And I love being able to pick up the New York Times wherever I am because I'm carrying an iPad. But at the same time, I also think it's important to read books and write books and read long articles and do things like that.
And coming back to the evolutionary point, it's still, we are still a narrative-seeking culture, and that involves the kind of linear thought you're talking about.
Well, I think so.
William David O., the book is Overconnected, The Promise and the Threat of the Internet. Bill, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.